To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people.
Because history has shown us that courage can be contagious, and hope can take on a life of its own.
I will bring you hope, and I ask only one thing in return.
We move now, together.
Not at all. Hope is not lost today. It is found.
Hope is what keeps you going.
Even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye, and say no. You move.
Welcome to the Skip Me Fanny Show. I'm Sean, and today on Signibus we have Sabrina Varvulius, author and creator of Ink, The Ways of Walls and Words, and a whole lot of short fiction and other lovely stuff. Welcome to the show, Sabrina.
Thank you for having me, Sean.
So we're here to talk about Ink, and folks who've been long listeners of the show may recall we interviewed you once upon a time about this book, or upon its original release, but a lot of new folks have come to the show who may not know much about this book. They may know your other work, maybe your more recent work, but for those that aren't familiar, can you tell us a little bit about this book, kind of give an introduction to it?
Sure. It opens as policies to mark and track immigrants and their children are put in place in a near future United States. And as the plot evolves, their freedoms really erode. They are permanently tattooed with biometric tattoos. And so the nickname of Ink, which is sort of a slur, comes into common use to refer to the people who have been tracked, who are being tracked and marked. And the book really explores a lot of what happens as governments single out a group to divest them of civil and human rights, and how that really expands and affects even those outside of the group. So one of the things that is really important about this is the community that builds around the Inks, and within the Ink communities themselves, the actions they take and resistance and so forth.
One of the things that really struck me as I was thinking about this interview, because I remember when we talked to you, you know, we talked about kind of immigration issues, and because obviously it's a central theme of the book. And I swear that when we did the original interview, we had talked about, like, this is really prescient. It's sort of dealing with some very big things. And then now that we're getting a re-release, I just feel like this book is far more terrifying than we probably gave it credit for when it first came out.
I think so. I think, you know, the world has really started to catch up with the dystopia that I imagined. And, you know, I give Rosarium Publishing, who are the publishers that re-released it, a huge amount of credit for the guts it takes to release it right at this moment when immigration, the rhetoric about immigration has become incredibly vitriolic and beyond what it was in 2012. And it was bad enough in 2012 that we were talking about it then. And as I was writing the book, it was bad enough that I was writing the book and envisioning this dystopia. But it has really, the world has really devolved. And I would say that, you know, we're just a few steps away from some of the grossest violations of human rights and civil rights I outline in it.
And I wonder, from some authors, you know, they'll write dystopias, but, you know, those dystopias often are kind of very detached, they're sort of very extreme, sort of dragging out these ideas to their most extreme extent. But the world never quite reaches many of these dystopias. It never quite catches there. Maybe pieces do. But given, you know, that you're kind of talking that in this really weird way, we're sort of way closer to the dystopia you made, you know, now, what, 6 years ago when you started working on it. How does it feel to you as the author that, like, your vision is coming true? Like, does that fill you with, like, existential dread?
Well, it would if I felt I had any part in it. But no, you know, I think a lot of it comes from the fact that I grew up under authoritarian regimes that were repressing portions of the population in Guatemala and in ever sort of widening circles. And I think if you live through that sort of government, you start being very wary of the very first signs that things are going there. And I think I was simply extremely sensitized to that in terms of the immigrant community that I was working with and interviewing anyway. And so, you know, I was really sensitive to the ways I really felt we were taking baby steps toward what I had experienced in Guatemala. So it's more a matter of the fact that, you know, my upbringing made me really vigilant or you know, makes me catastrophize, who knows, you know, whatever your perspective is. But, and I think that that's what was possible for me to make something that was within the realm of reason. The other thing I want to bring up is that a number of the incidents or policies that affect the characters in my novel are things that are based on sort of historical precedent. So there's that too. You know, we have in the past certainly detained people based on ethnicity and put them into internment centers or, you know, whatever we want to call them. There have been a number of different ways that we have targeted people in our history. There was a Mexican repatriation in the 30s that also repatriated Mexican Americans to Mexico. So, you know, these are things that don't come out of the imagination. They come out of somebody, you know, they do come out of the imagination in the sense that you retool them or they inform what you're creating, but they're there if we're willing to look at our past and what's happening.
Which, of course, I think seems to be the problem, is that a lot of people don't seem to want to do that. That there's so much in the world where, like, we should not be, you should read that, and that's not something to model your life after. Like, you should know. So, as you mentioned, right, Rosarium is re-releasing this, and as you also mentioned, and I think I agree, that it seems very brave to release this now, given just all of the conversation. But so how did this happen? What was the process that led you to, they're going to re-release this book?
Well, we discussed it because circumstances presented themselves that made the book become available. And Bill Campbell, who is the founder and head honcho over at Rosarium, had always told me that he had liked Ink and that it was a book that he wished that he had published. And so I approached him and said, okay, well, you know, it's suddenly available. Would you be interested in re-releasing it? And let's talk about how, you know, there's several levels of bravery in my estimation in his decision to do so. One is that re-releases really don't make a lot of money. They don't make a lot of money for big presses and even less for small presses. But yes, you know, I think that, you know, one of the hallmarks of Rosarium is that they really grapple with some really deep issues and they are a really brave press. And I feel like, you know, I keep saying this, Bill has never said this, but I say this, I feel like publishing Ink at this point during the Trump administration, and given the language he's used and all of the tools that he's used to repress and strip immigrants of their civil and human rights, is a real act of resistance. And so I'm just so delighted about the fact that, you know, that small presses are where courage lives, I think, these days.
That's really interesting, because, you know, I used to think that in the sense of, like, small presses often would take greater chances from, like, a literary perspective, sort of, like, this book isn't writing in, like, the standard sort of pop writing style, so we'll publish this book because it's sort of different. But I hadn't thought about it as taking more chances in the sense of the actual content could potentially be the challenge. Which is, I just think that's very, very interesting. And it makes me wonder, you know, if I go and start looking into what the big six publishers are doing, you know, how often are they releasing works that are a challenge in the same way that this work is to the sort of authoritarian, either over or undertones or both of the world we're sort of living in. You know, the only kind of resistance I can think of is like when publishers like publish some book that's about Trump as a sort of middle finger to him. But I don't know how effective those works are as a challenge so much as just to make him go crazy on his Twitter account.
You know, I think that they're, big publishers have the advantage of being able to do sort of multi-front aspects of you know, of grappling with an issue. So they can have, you know, nonfiction books that deal with aspects of our immigration history or our immigration policy. But I do feel like, you know, in terms of the fiction, there certainly are a number of big press writers who are grappling with those issues. And, you know, like I can, in a variety of ways, like Reina Grande has had several of her books published by big publishers, and hers is really first nonfiction and then fiction centered on her undocumented journey to the United States. And certainly, you know, people like Jhumpa Lahiri writes about the immigrant experience all the time. You know, I mean, it's not to say that they don't grapple with it, but they grapple with it in different ways. And they don't grapple with it in with the immediacy that I found Rosarium did. You know, I'm, you know, Beyond Ink, I remember being really impressed when they put out a graphic novel, Artists Against Police Brutality, right, you know, sort of as that consequence of everything that was happening right after Ferguson. And it's a really, it's a great anthology, but also it's that they're mobile and responsive and have really the will to put out works by, I believe, I think almost everybody, if not everybody on their roster of writers are people of color. Or, you know, I mean, I know they have a number of Latinos and a lot of African-American writers and Asian-American writers. So I think, you know, that's one of the ways that they're absolutely a different sort of press. And I'm grateful to them, really, honestly, because the truth is that Ink was going to go out of print. You know, if unless they were willing to take it on, it was going to go out of print. And it's not the right time for it to go out of print, in my very humble opinion.
I agree with that opinion. It should be a cautionary warning, this book. And people need to read it. And if it's out of print, it just becomes more difficult for people to read it for obvious reasons. So is this just a straight re-release or did you make any adjustments or changes?
No, there are no adjustments or changes. Although, believe me, you know, within the 6 years that it's been out, so much has changed in social media and so much has changed in terms of the way newsrooms are set up and the way news is reported, that there are times I think to myself, God, I wish I could have, you know, revised it. But what it does have is a new introduction by Latina magical realist and also nonfiction and also just crossing genres all over the place, a writer who I really admire. Her name is Kathleen Alcala. And she tends to be better known, actually, in literary circles than in speculative circles. But that's changing, thank God. And she is she's really fantastic. And she wrote an introduction to it, which I'm really grateful for, because to some extent she contextualizes, you know, what this means, what immigrant narratives are. And she talks about it being, you know, certain Latino right within the Latino speculative fiction world, certain writers being sort of new journalists. And so, you know, I'm really happy with what she did in terms of introducing it to people.
glad you brought that up, because I was hoping to ask about that and about getting an introduction from her, because I was not familiar with her work until I saw the introduction, and then I went digging and was like, oh, this is somebody who's going to go on my reading list immediately.
She's really fantastic, and I had read her work, you know, way before actually I started writing speculative fiction. And because I come to this from sort of a Latin American upbringing, and I think she may, I'm not going to put words in her mouth, but I think she may also feel this way as a U.S. Latina. You know, I don't see those hard and fast borders or lines between genres and literary fiction. So, you know, of course, you know, for me, she was both. And I was surprised when we ended up in an anthology called Latino Rising together to realize that there were a lot of people within the speculative fiction world that I sort of was conversing with who hadn't heard of her or who thought of her exclusively as a literary writer. And she's just such a powerhouse. I'm glad if the introduction to my novel introduces people to her work.
That's great. Interestingly enough, you kind of bring up this idea that you know, the way in which people kind of flip between different types of writing, and that those lines are not necessarily, specifically, like you'd mentioned the literary genre, that the lines between those are not really, they're sort of like weird and permeable rather than these hard divisions. And I know for yourself that you've done a lot of work that is not fiction entirely. I believe it would be fair to say you've done a fair bit of journalism. As somebody who'd worked and works and still continues to work in that particular world, in what way does that kind of influence your writing?
Look, you know, to some extent, they are both journalistic writing and fiction writing. Clearly, you know, they have different conventions and different strengths, and they are very distinct one from the other, but they're both forms of truth telling as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, my fiction has often been informed by journalistic work I've done, by coverage I've done. It allows me sort of the bones on which to build a true fiction. But for example, a story that appeared at Tor.com in 2014, a story called Skin in the Game, was prompted really by my spending time at the really famous drug encampment in Philadelphia's Barrio in advance of a story that one of the reporters that I edited and supervised was doing about the encampment. So I spent a great deal of time at the encampment, and I edited this really wonderful piece by a reporter named Emma Restrepo. And I realized that I wanted to do something fictional set in, at least in part, in that drug encampment. So it's a way that it was informing and sort of inspiring, but it was a whole, obviously it's not a competing narrative, it's a different narrative about that. And the same way I wrote a series of articles and an award-winning editorial about an incident in Philadelphia where a young Latino man went to a peace concert that was being given for a victim of a shooting, and he was shot at the peace concert, and then sort of his investigation was just sort of dropped. And the very bare bones of that story became a story that Uncanny Magazine published called El Cantar of Rising Sun, which really, you know, was sort of cast as a golden age epic, you know, and sort of it being performed at as an epic of that time, like El Cid or whatever. And that, so, you know, the journalism tends to inspire me to go elsewhere with some of the specifics of the story tied in, but to go somewhere else. And I think, honestly, the fiction the fact that I'm a fiction writer makes me really, really pay attention to the craft of writing in my journalism. You know, and I find that I, as an editor, as a news editor, I'm very exacting with the reporters who have reported to me. You know, it's not enough that you're covering a story. You know, you're not a, you can't just be a stenographer of what you observed or what the, you know, what the facts are. You have to be somebody who can craft a story. And I think that that really comes from the fiction writer in me.
Fantastic. It makes me think a lot about the amount of effort that actually can go into sort of journalistic writing to turn an event into a story, which, you know, seems to be that it could be greatly benefited by people just, you know, learning the craft of creative writing in a way, which is what I tell my students all the time is, you know, the best way to become a better writer is to write and read, you know, and write your own little stories, write whatever. I mean, it doesn't really matter. The whole point is the effort makes you better. So Ink is here. It's out now. It is in electronic and in paperback form, so folks can get it in whatever format they prefer. But what have you got coming next? Like, what's next for you? Do you have any work lined up, or are you working on a new secret project that you totally want to give us a scoop on?
Well, I've been writing a lot of stories, short stories. So I currently have a story up at Apex Magazine. And I have some short stories coming out in, you know, probably places people think are a little unlikely for me. So, for example, I wrote my first kaiju story this year, and it's coming out sometime soon from Outland Publications. Actually, I have the bones of two different collections, short story collections. One really focused on what I informally call magical Philadelphia. They're all Philadelphia stories, and the other one is a more selected collection. I haven't started shopping those around, and I have a novella that I'm shopping around. So, you know, conceivably you could be overwhelmed with a barrage of Sabrina Rivulia's writing, you know, or not, depending on, you know, how the stars are shining any given day.
So where can folks find you and your work?
So I am sort of on and off doing events in Philadelphia. Upcoming, you just missed out on a reading, but you know, keep your eyes on my Twitter at follow the lead, spelled LEDE, because I always announce the events I've lined up. And Ink is, it just got a review not too long ago at NPR. It's available at Amazon. It's available on Rosarium Publishing's website. It is at, I imagine, selected bookstores. I know Penn Center Bookstore in Philadelphia has copies. My local Barnes & Noble, you can order it, but it doesn't have copies. But, you know, some Barnes & Nobles might. Who knows? But it's pretty widely available at this point. And I encourage people to see there's some anthologies coming out soon. Sunspot Jungle, which is a 2-volume enormous anthology with works by people from across the world that's coming from Rosarium that has my work in it. There's an anthology, several Outland Publication anthologies coming out, Knaves anthology. There's an Upper Rubber Boot anthology coming out, I believe, in January of in their Women Up to No Good series. One of them has a story. So just keep your eyes open. And there's all sorts of work of mine coming out. This has been a really productive year for me in terms of my literary output. So I'm happy to say that that for once, when I write my requisite, please consider these for awards, there'll be more than one entry in there.
Yeah, you've certainly been busy. Holy moly.
I have.
And obviously, you can go to your website, which is sabrinavorvoulias.com, and we'll put a link in the show notes, but the last name is spelled V-O-U-R-V-O-U-L-I-A-S. So, and then Sabrina's like, you know, Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Well, thank you so much, Sabrina, for coming on the show and talking to me about your work and obviously some other things we talked about, which was exciting.
Thank you, Sean. I really appreciate it.
All right, folks. And obviously, if you have any questions, you can send us an email, skiffingfanti@gmail.com, or follow us on like the internet places at like Twitter at skiffingfanti. Awkward ending and scene.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanti Show. I'm Elizabeth, and today on Signal Boost we have Stephanie Gunn, author of Icefall. Welcome to the show, Steph.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So why don't you tell us a little about yourself and about Icefall?
Okay, well, I am a scientist by trade, though I'm a non-practicing scientist these days, thanks to chronic illness, which interrupted my career. I've got a PhD in genetics and microbiology and immunology, somewhere in there too. It's all kind of mixed up together. But I've been writing for longer than I've been studying science. I also wrangle two small humans on a daily basis, which is where my brain leaks out of my ears far too frequently. Icefall is a science fiction novella, which is essentially about mountain climbing in space in the future, where humans have left Earth behind and colonized the universe through the use of what I call grey space, which is basically a type of hyperspeed which only goes to some places. And I've actually got a really good quote from a review which really sums up Icefall well, which is from a review from Heidi, who quoted, "It is about mountaineering space lesbians having religious vocational issues." I really like that.
It does sum it up quite well.
It does.
Australia is a notoriously flat continent without what might be considered proper mountains. So what was it that drew you to write about mountaineering?
Yes, I'd like to point out as well, I live in Perth, where there really are no mountains. We have hills, and that's about as high as it gets. Where very occasionally it does snow on one of the highest ones, but I think that is pretty much like 3 grains of snow every year. I blame this all on flicking through television channels one Sunday evening and finding a documentary on George Mallory called The Wildest Dream. And for whatever reason, I had never had any interest in mountains, mountaineering, extreme sport, thought it was boring, started watching this, thought, that's interesting. I'm going to find a biography of George Mallory. Found that, read that. I'm going to find some of these books in the bibliography. Found them, read them, kept reading, kept finding more movies and documentaries, kept reading. Yeah, I've kind of got a really big stack of books on mountaineering now. But I really got fascinated with the female mountaineers, who basically got forgotten about a lot of the time, and some of the things that they had to deal with on the mountains. And I can't remember which female it was who was talking about particularly having to deal with menstruation while mountain climbing with a bunch of men, because the idea is you try not to leave waste behind, so you burn what you can. So, of course, she had to sit in the middle of a camp with men and burn all of her used tampons. And this is what got me thinking more and more about how women would cope with it and what you would do. And somehow in there it spiraled out into science fiction and weird mountains and the kind of people who would climb the kind of weird, more extreme mountains you'd find out on other planets.
Mountaineering comes with a lot of colonist baggage that you dig into. Your main character is actually a descendant of the Sherpas of Tibet. So I was wondering, was the heritage something that was part of the character from the beginning of the story for you, or was it something that developed along the way?
It was absolutely there from the beginning, because that was one of the things that really fascinated me, and just this contradiction of the Sherpas in particular who guard on Everest. I mean, it is a sacred place for them. It is essentially their goddess, and because of money, essentially, they are trespassing in these sacred places to basically do most of the climbing for white people. I mean, I got reading about a lot of the famous quote-unquote disasters on Everest, like the 94 one in particular, and a lot of the people who survived going up there, essentially, in weather they shouldn't have been climbing in. The only reason they survived is because Sherpas sometimes carried them on their backs and risked their own lives for these white people, essentially so they could feed their families back at home, because it was the most money they could make. And I just found that fascinating, especially with the character of Aisha, a character who exemplifies all of that, worshipping mountains as sacred places, who then became fascinated by them, and just the idea of why she would climb. And that's kind of where I ended up with the character of Maggie. It's like, why? What's another reason to do anything is because you fall in love with someone. But yeah, she was always going to have that kind of cultural heritage. Well, I thought that was very important. I mean, otherwise you're just writing another story about basically white people. Well, basically I'm writing as a white person, writing about white people going and basically stomping over everyone else to go and plant a flag somewhere, which is something that really bothers me.
Oh, I thought you handled the aspect of the story really well, and I really enjoyed the spiritual aspects of the story, especially from Aisha's point of view. So, and you mentioned before that you have a background as a scientist, and the story, I feel, strikes a really good balance between the scientific and the spiritual. So was that something that came naturally for you, or was that something that you worked hard at?
That's something that I live with as a daily basis conflict for me, being a scientist who is also very spiritual. I have lived with that conflict for pretty much as long as I can remember. I identify as a druid, which is obviously a slightly different thing. But yeah, it's something that always fascinates me about humanity, the fact that we live with these contradictions and they don't completely tear us apart. So it was naturally something I wanted to explore in Icefall, and something I think that I tend to put into a lot of stuff that I write, just because it is something that I live with. And I'm in my 40s and still haven't quite reconciled beyond the fact that all these things exist in the same world and the same universe.
So another conflict that comes up in the story is Aisha's uneasy relationship with technology. So on one hand, it enables her to witness her wife's mountain climb. But on the other, she's physically incompatible with some of the virtual reality tech. Do you feel like the current science fiction leans towards showing technology to be an unreservedly good thing and accessible to everyone?
I think it's something that's, again, it's a massive conflict, because you see how much the world is developing in terms of technology. I mean, I see my children growing up with this world where they're spending time, for example, my son is right now playing a computer game with several dozen other people around the world who he will never meet. And yet you think there is another child in another country who doesn't have access to drinking water. It's just, yeah, I feel like it's the kind of thing that not everyone is going to have the privilege to access, both financially and physically. I mean, I think about people who have, even someone who's blind who has to have accommodations to use a phone or a smartphone. And that's one of the things that I actually want to go on to explore in other stories with Aisha, is how this group of people is dealing with a world that provides essentially no access to them, to 99% of it. And we see Aisha building her other bots that show her things, but no one else is obviously going out of the way to do it, because they're just off in their happy little la-la VR world all the time. Yeah, just think about what that'd be like, being shut out of a world that everyone else takes for granted, basically.
I think there was another thing that came across very well in the story, in that kind of isolation from her perspective, even though she doesn't necessarily see it as isolation herself. But it was really visceral for me, I think, and I thought you handled it well.
Yeah, and I feel like some of my own experiences with chronic illness as well comes into that. And so many of my friends who have chronic illnesses, I see them being so isolated from the world, and the world just goes on without you, basically, if you're stuck in bed because you're too in pain or too fatigued to get up. The world doesn't care. And yeah, it's like, how much can you go out of your way to fix that when you're the person who doesn't have the energy or the focus, and there's no one there to reach out to you, basically, because they're too busy with their own lives.
And I think that definitely comes through in the story as well, with Aisha's wife so focused on her climb as well. She doesn't necessarily have the time or focus for Aisha in that way.
Yeah, and it's not malicious. It's just the fact that she has this obsession, which is, I mean, that's what people do. Then people aren't malicious because someone can't access a world that they can access easily or can't travel to a place that they can't travel to. Everyone's just busy and focused on themselves, and it's easy to forget about who you leave behind, basically.
Now, just to go back to what you said, you have more stories coming up with these characters?
I have two more novellas planned at the moment, so I'm in the planning stage of the next one right now.
Oh, that's so wonderful.
There's no solid plans yet for when they'll come out or anything, but yeah, I'm definitely going to be writing them and they will appear somehow.
That's really exciting. I'm really looking forward to those.
I love this world and I love these characters, and I can't leave it where it ends.
It was a bit of a cliffhanger.
Yeah, literally.
You mentioned it was a novella, and you managed to pack a lot of themes and world buildings in. So was the drafting process complicated?
Amusingly, it was originally a short story. So, yeah, it was originally a short story, which I had a couple of beta readers look at. I can't even remember what I was writing it for something, but I honestly can't remember what at the moment. And yeah, a couple of beta readers looked at it and just said, you know what, you could expand this. So I thought, right, okay, I'll do that just to see if I can practice writing a novella and expanding it. And yeah, went through. I'm a very slow writer, unfortunately, and I retype every single draft, and my hands hate me for that. So I probably went through at least 3 or 4 full drafts before I sent it into 12th Planet Press, and then it had a fair amount of editing from there from Elisa as well, who is incredibly awesome to work with as an editor, by the way. And she's taken away my right to use the word that, because I overuse it a lot. The best editors are the ones who find things like that, I swear. I've worked with some editors that have just improved my writing so much. Just the people who find those little ticks that you're just blind to. But yeah, that was brilliant working with Elisa. And with a couple of other people she brought in to have a look at the draft and check my science, because apparently I don't know how gravity works. Sorry, I'm a biologist.
Well, that's really exciting. It sounds like the process was really rewarding for you.
It really was. I mean, honestly, a few years ago, probably maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, I sat down and wrote out this dream list of things I would love to accomplish in my writing career. And fairly high up that list was to get published in 12th Planet Press, which I initially did in Defying Doomsday. And then even further up the list I had was get a novella published in 12th Planet Press. So I got to tick off a few very big things there for me.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, I'm more than a bit pleased with getting published with them.
So, where can we find you and Ice?
The best place to find me with all my links online is at stephaniegunn.com. I'm also at stephanie_gunn on Twitter and I believe Instagram. And you can find Icefall at 12th Planet Press, and it's also published at Amazon in Australia, the UK and the US, and on Kobo, I believe.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us on Signal Boost. Go check out Icefall.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to support us, you can find us at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so at our email at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, and on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro and outro music comes from Dimension by Creo. You can find out more about them at freemusicarchive.org.